From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Cabinet shake-up. Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius resigns after months of criticism over the much-maligned healthcare rollout.
Serving as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, when the United States of America finally declared that quality, affordable healthcare is not a privilege, but it is a right for every single citizen.
Also today, our UN correspondent reports on the shocking extent of sexual violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And we have the latest on the explosive murder trial of Olympic blade runner Oscar Pistorius.
In fact, you knew that Riva was behind the door and you shot at her. That is the only thing that makes sense. You shot at her knowing that she's behind the door.
It's not true, my lady.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a brief summary of our day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Ukraine's interim prime minister has offered a devolution of powers to the country's eastern regions in an attempt to defuse a standoff with pro-Russian separatists. Arseniy Yatsenyuk has been holding talks with regional leaders in the city of Donetsk. Activists there have occupied a major government building. This comes as the West continues to warn Russia against a military intervention in eastern Ukraine. And Prime Minister Yatsenyuk says the issue can be solved without force if protesters engage with his proposals.
We need to tackle this problem only in a peaceful manner. But we've made an offer. They are to leave the premise of the state administration, to be disarmed, and we as a state of Ukraine can guarantee them that they won't be detained or arrested. But it's up to them to decide.
So there's a possibility you could use force?
There is a possibility that we can do and we will do everything to prevent a crackdown.
Crimea, the area of Ukraine annexed by Russia in March, has unanimously adopted its new constitution. The document formalizes Crimea as a subject of the Russian Federation. The constitution has faced criticism by the community of ethnic Tatars in Crimea, who say the law does not indicate the Tatars' special status and their rights to self-determination. The White House is refusing to issue a visa for Iran's controversial pick for United Nations envoy. The U.S. accuses Hamid Aboutalebi of participating in the hostile takeover of the U.S. embassy in Tehran in 1979. The U.S. Congress has been outraged at Mr. Aboutalebi's nomination and passed a bill prohibiting people found to be engaged in terrorism from entering the U.S. President Obama has been under pressure to follow suit and has now decided not to issue Mr. Aboutalebi a visa. The United Nations is headquartered in New York, and denying visas to foreign leaders who wish to attend is a highly uncommon move. Mr. Aboutalebi insists he played only a small role in the Tehran embassy crisis, in which 52 Americans were held hostage for over a year. Venezuela's government and opposition leaders have begun peace talks aimed at ending weeks of volatile protests in the country. Andrea Arenas has the latest.
The six-hour-long meeting between Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro and opposition leader Enrique Capriles was held at the presidential palace in Caracas and was broadcast live on television. Foreign ministers from Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, and a Vatican representative attended to keep the talks on track. It coincided with a day full of more violent street protests, which raised the death toll to 41. Andrea Arenas, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. President Barack Obama announced his nominee for a new Secretary of Health and Human Services hours after the news his controversial cabinet member was resigning. Sylvia Matthews-Burwell is the current head of the Office of Budget and Management, and if confirmed, will replace Kathleen Sebelius, who left following heavy criticism over the unveiling of Obamacare. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has more.
The embattled Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, resigned after months of criticism over the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, the health insurance legislation nicknamed Obamacare. U.S. President Barack Obama named the federal government's budget and management chief, Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, to this cabinet post.
And she'll need to be a proven manager because these are tough tasks, big challenges.
In his remarks, President Obama noted that everyone was bumped and bruised by how the landmark health care bill came into effect, but that job got done and 7.5 million Americans now have health care insurance, which they didn't have before. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
A United Nations report has revealed that Honduras has the world's highest murder rate. It's the second year running that the Central American country has topped the list. Nick Harper reports from UN headquarters in New York.
Latin American countries take up all of the top five positions. Honduras leads with a rate of just over 90 murders per 100,000 people, almost double the rate of second place Venezuela. Belize is third, followed by El Salvador and Guatemala in fourth and fifth. The global murder rate is six people in every 100,000, but on average, only 43% of killings lead to convictions. The report from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime says improvements are needed in development, security, and the agenda against violence to bring the rates down. Nick Harper, New York.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. President Obama has picked Budget Chief Sylvia Matthews-Burwell to replace Health and Human Services Director Kathleen Sebelius. Following her resignation, Mr. Obama said Sebelius would be remembered for being the person in charge when America decided quality, affordable health care was a right, not a privilege.
And the final score speaks for itself. There are 7.5 million people across the country that have the security of health insurance, most of them for the very first time, and that's because of the woman standing next to me here today.
For more on the cabinet shakeup, I spoke to White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, Linda Feldman.
In the grander scheme of things, it was to be expected that Kathleen Sebelius would leave certainly before the end of Obama's presidency. I mean, she's really been on the griddle from the very start.
Right.
And the Obamacare rollout was such a mess that she's, by all indications, exhausted. So I think the timing in many ways did make sense. They've just finished open enrollment, and the elections are several months away, so this kind of clears the decks and gets her out of there before she can become a real lightning rod for the election.
And despite the barrage of criticism thrown at her over the botched ACA rollout, President Obama said she went out on a high. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I think, well, if you look at it narrowly, yes. I mean, the fact that they reached 7.5 million enrollments after the horrendous rollout, I mean, they basically lost the first 2 months and came very close to having to start over on that website. So the fact that they exceeded their goal of 7 million really was a pleasant surprise for Kathleen Sebelius, and I think by bowing out now, she does get to go out on a bit of a high note, but certainly the law is still fairly toxic for Democrats and could contribute to their loss of the Senate in November.
And how have Republicans greeted the news of her resignation?
Well, it's been interesting. I mean, some people have been actually kind of gracious. I saw that Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah applauded her for her perseverance during a very difficult rollout of the law, even though he's not a supporter of the law. I think he appreciated how hard she worked to save it amid all the problems. And I think what you're also seeing from Republicans is saying, yes, Kathleen Sebelius was running a terrible law, implementing a terrible law, but now that she's gone, the law is still here, and that's the real problem. The problem isn't Kathleen Sebelius. So now they're training their sights on the law itself and not just her.
So if we can now turn our attention to her replacement, President Obama has nominated his budget director. She's taking on the government's largest domestic agency. Mm-hmm. What do we know about her?
Well, she's an interesting person. She's from a small town in West Virginia, which you don't normally associate with someone who ends up going to Harvard and then wins a Rhodes Scholarship to study at Oxford, which is her life story. Obviously very intelligent, but also praised for her low-key manner and demeanor. She was involved in budget negotiations on Capitol Hill last year. which didn't work, but Republicans came out saying that they felt she was someone they could do business with. And this is something that Kathleen Sebelius was never able to achieve. So it's possible that, Sylvia Burwell will have more success in working with kind of antagonistic Republicans on Capitol Hill than Sebelius did.
Does Ms. Burwell have an established record in healthcare, though?
She does not. And that can cut two ways. You've got people arguing that she's not qualified for this position because she doesn't have experience in the healthcare world or in running such a large agency. But then you also have people arguing that because she doesn't have the background on the policy, her skill as a manager will rise to the top. She's, by many accounts, a very talented manager, works well with others. Is able to look at a large bureaucracy and help it to make sense. And so the fact that she's distanced a bit from healthcare policy could help her be seen as an honest broker as the government goes forward with implementing the law.
Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. This is FSN Reports. Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius, on trial for the murder of his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp, again broke down under cross-examination in court today. The prosecutor continued his aggressive line of questioning, calling Mr. Pistorius a liar. The track star maintains he mistook his girlfriend for an intruder. The trial is now in recess until Monday. With the latest, our London correspondent Ollie Barrett spoke to FSN's Gary Alfonso in South Africa.
Oscar Pistorius has been accused of lying while explaining to a South African court why he didn't check where his girlfriend was on the night he shot her. The sprinter admits killing Reva Steenkamp, but claims it was an accident and that he thought there was an intruder in his house. Prosecutor Kerry Nell pressed Mr. Pistorius on his actions when he heard sounds in his bathroom.
I thought that she was awake and I thought that she was next to me, my lady.
Now,
I knew she was next to me.
What I don't understand is why you wouldn't make sure that Reva is fine before you storm off.
I'm not sure, my lady. I was in a panic and my thought was to get between the perceived danger and Reva as quick as I could.
It's because it's not the truth, Mr. Pistorius. That's why it's difficult to explain why you did not see if she was fine. Isn't that so?
That's incorrect, my lady.
It has been a high-octane week in the courtroom in Pretoria, and our South Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso joins me now from Johannesburg. And Gary, that clash between Kerry Nell and Oscar Pistorius about how the sprinter reacted on thinking someone was in his house, what is it that the prosecution is trying to show with that line of questioning?
Because there's no jury system in South Africa, what's happening is that the prosecution is using the opportunity to paint the character of Oscar Pistorius in front of the judge and the two assessors who will ultimately be deciding the outcome of this trial. What Kerry Nell is doing is to paint the character of Oscar Pistorius as somebody who's cannot remember details when he's asked to and when it's relevant, but other times he's pretty good at remembering the finer details and small details of things that he said earlier or he might have said earlier. So that line of questioning possibly aimed at what Nell's been doing all week long, which is trying to get under the skin of Oscar Pistorius. And many legal opinions here in South Africa say that Kerry Nell is getting that right and is getting to Oscar Pistorius and possibly getting him to open up and expose the personality that the prosecution believes is behind Oscar Pistorius and behind that shooting and killing of Reva Steenkamp that night, obviously dismissing his version.
And Gary, we also heard Mr. Pistorius pressed on whether Reva Steenkamp screamed or shouted when he shot her. How did that go down in court?
Well, again, it's about the version of Oscar Pistorius and what the state is implying, that other people have heard a woman scream And Oscar Pistorius saying that while he was shooting, it would have been impossible to hear anybody scream, let alone a woman behind a closed door. So how that went down is perhaps, again, showing and indicating that Oscar Pistorius was perhaps being specific again about things that he experienced and wasn't aware of the bigger issues, which is, again, what the prosecutor asked, is why a guy that is afraid of crime would walk towards intruders rather than trying to secure Rivas Steenkamp elsewhere in the house and possibly evade any intruders or burglars.
And Kerry Nell has been pretty upfront this week several times accusing Oscar Pistorius of lying. He seemed pretty fearsome in court this week, Kerry Nell. Does he have that reputation in South Africa?
Absolutely. His nickname is the Pitbull in South Africa, and many accused, and in fact, most people sitting in prison today on 25-year sentences in South Africa have been in some way connected to a Kerry Nell prosecution. So he's the most successful prosecutor in South Africa over the past few years, and he's been very effective at doing exactly what he's doing right now, which is punching little holes and inconsistencies in the versions of people that are trying to put forward a specific testimony in a bail application or even in their plea application, but when it comes to testimony, telling slightly different stories. And of course, the defense will argue that that's not impossible to happen, but definitely a very good week for the prosecution of Kerry Nell and the South African Prosecution Service.
Gary, Oscar Pistorius has been very emotional this week. He's broken down several times under Kerry Nell's questioning. How is the South African media reading his demeanor in court this week?
You know that across social media and radio platforms in South Africa over the past few days, more and more callers and people have come out saying that they really believed Oscar Pistorius when he broke down crying, talking about his love for Rivas Steenkamp and how he regrets doing what he did that night. But this week, some difference of opinion emerging, people saying, well, the Oscar that's starting to be a very, very defensive person in the witness stand is perhaps not that same sensitive person. And Kerry Nell, the prosecutor, was pointing that out very clearly, that he thought Oscar Pistorius was somebody who cried very easily when it suited him. And that goes for the rest of his testimony, only going and saying yes to questions very pertinently when it suited him.
Gary, thank you. FSN's Johannesburg Bureau Chief, Gary Alfonso.
Now, a United Nations report has shown the shocking extent of sexual violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. A lack of punishment for perpetrators has made the east of the country one of the most dangerous places in Africa for women to live. According to the UN report, government soldiers and rebel fighters are raping with impunity. Our UN correspondent Nick Harper reports from New York.
From a distance, the eastern hills of the Democratic Republic of Congo seem peaceful. On the surrounding lakes, men fish, and women wash clothes at the water's edge. But among the hills of the Kivu provinces hides heartbreak. This is the place that the United Nations has described as the rape capital of the world. Mama Masika knows the extent of the problem. In one attack, she says she was raped by 10 men. Her young children were in the next room.
They started raping me. There were 10 of them. I know because I was counting them. I could hear my children crying, "Mama, they are beating us." It was awful.
She's seen just how commonplace these attacks have become. She now runs an orphanage for children born from rape.
Everyone rapes. Civilians, even police, even pastors. Everyone rapes.
According to the United Nations, in the last 4 years, 3,600 cases of sexual attacks were reported in eastern DRC. The majority were against women. But many rapes go unreported. The stigma that comes with being raped means victims are often shunned by the communities and their families after they've been attacked. And perpetrators are seldom punished. These men admit rape was just part of their lives.
If I had a sexual urge, then I would rape until I was satisfied. Afterwards, I would feel calm, but if I still needed sex, I would find another girl and rape her.
I've raped a lot of women. I've raped over 50, sticking a gun knife between their legs and whipping them with wires.
The majority of rapes are carried out by the militia and government troops fighting for control in the region. fighting that has spanned two decades. Rape and murder often go hand in hand, as was the case for this woman, who didn't wish to be identified.
Two soldiers entered the room where I was sleeping and raped me. When my brother shouted at them, he was shot with bullets until he died. They killed him like that, and then they dirtied me like that.
There are even superstitions among soldiers that raping children will stop them from being killed. The youngest victim in the UN report was just 2 years old.
The report acknowledges the effort.
To date, the UN says only three government soldiers have been convicted of rape. At a special briefing in New York, top UN officials called on the DRC government to stop impunity for these attacks. Here's the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay.
I understand the challenges. However, I certainly hold the government responsible for lack of political will in the delivery of convictions.
The head of UN peacekeeping operations, Hervé Ladsous, says the only way forward is to ensure culprits are held accountable by all levels of society, from local police to judges and the prison system.
There's no point, after all, in putting somebody, a perpetrator, behind bars for a short period, when after that short period, that person can escape and start committing the same crimes again.
UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence in Conflict, Zeni Bangura, noted more soldiers are being brought to trial, but said the DRC must step up the fight against impunity for rape.
It is only when the people of the DRC can live free of the threat of conflict-related sexual violence that the country can reach its full potential.
The main rebel group, the M23, recently surrendered, but the region remains volatile as different groups come to the fore to vie for control. While that continues, the UN says rape will remain a weapon of war, with women very much caught up in the conflict. Nick Harper at the United Nations in New York.
Now, the Belgium government has decided to crush its entire stockpile of illegal ivory. It's a statement against the poaching of African elephants, who've seen their populations depleted substantially in recent years. Conservationists say they'll face extinction if nothing is done. FSN's Jack Parrock reports from Brussels.
The sound of millions of dollars worth of ivory reduced to dust. Heavyweight machines destroying Belgium's stockpile of 1.7 tons of illegal ivory. Mainly confiscated at Brussels Airport. Global appetite for elephant tusks has trebled since 1998, driven especially by new wealth in Asia. Belgium may seem an unlikely place for ivory trade to be such a problem. But Miet van Looy from the Confederation on International Trade in Endangered Species says there's a reason why so much is recovered here.
Flights coming in from Africa and flying away to the Asian countries. So we are the link between the countries of origin, where the elephant lives, where the ivory is poached, and the destination countries, the Asian countries.
Over 35,000 elephants are killed every year for this trade, according to the International Fund for Animal Welfare. That's one every 15 minutes. Most of the ivory comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Burundi, Gabon, and Tanzania. Smugglers do things like coat it with plastic to avoid detection as it goes through customs. Dr. Diodorus B. Kamala is the Tanzanian ambassador to the Belux region and EU. He says in Africa, the poachers are adapting as well.
Tanzania dedicated over 46,000 of land for national parks, which is bigger than the size of Belgium. But poachers every day, they come up with the new technology, with the new techniques, while we find the resources available for governments are very limited.
Belgium's 1.7-ton stockpile would have sold for millions of dollars in Asia. Its value is slightly less in Europe.
The problem is because China has a legal market, that legal market is providing cover for illegal ivory to be laundered.
Conservationists like Grace Gabriel, Asia Regional Director for the International Fund for Animal Welfare, say the symbolic crushing of this ivory is a very positive step. But more needs to be done to really prevent the growth in the trade.
If we want to protect elephants, we need to strengthen laws to make ivory trade illegal in all circumstances.
From now on, Belgium will destroy its illegal ivory once a year. What's left over once it's crushed will be turned into artwork to try to educate people about the depleting elephant populations in Africa. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
And finally, blockbuster movies have massively boosted the success of comic book franchises from heavyweights such as Marvel and DC Comics. The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and X-Men Days of Future Past are both due for US release in May. And while it might be harder these days to find superheroes on the shelves of magazine retailers, Marvel characters are also reaching younger, contemporary audiences in a digital format. FSN's Rebecca Bowring reports.
Hellboy, comic superhero and demonic force for good, comes to life on an iPad. The red-skinned, stone-fisted Dark Horse Comics creation is just one of a multitude of characters translated into motion book format by Madefire, entrepreneurs in the field of digital publishing. It all started more than 5 years ago in a pub in East London. Madefire co-founder Ben Wustenholme asked himself and his future business partner what comics would become when people were reading them on a screen.
We were very interested in, okay, how are books going to move into digital reading? And we felt like visual books are going to be a lot more appropriate when you're reading on a device.
In California, Wustenholme and his co-founder Liam Sharp partnered with a software engineer to develop a platform providing interactive reading experiences for smartphones and tablets. Storytelling is enhanced by movement, sound, and character depth while preserving the artistic style of the graphic novel. Sharp has been working with comics for 27 years.
We were always very keen that it would be a reading experience, not a watching experience. So that was a key principle that guided the thinking. But then we thought, okay, what if you could stick your head inside a piece of art? What would that look like?
The formula seems to be working. Legendary publisher DC saw sales of its digital comics rocket 200% in 2012. In collaboration with Madefire, it recently launched its Batman Multiverse digital comic series, where readers are presented with choices that determine the path of the story. It's the first time Batman's been reimagined specifically for screen reading. Wustenholme says it's been hard to take on an established industry and its passionate fan base.
I think it's fair to say that digital has been seen as the enemy for many years, and probably about only a year or two ago, I think it became an ally. So I think the readership and the publishing community felt like, oh, it's not going to totally replace print, it's going to play a complementary role if it's done well.
Despite what Wustenholme sees as a wider acceptance of the genre, digital comics do still face some opposition. In the Fantastic Comics store in Berkeley, sales are up because of the popularity of comic-related TV and movies. But manager Jeff Carter says motion books won't inspire more interest.
It's more of a hindrance. I mean, the production value, I mean, the amount of money they have to put in the production always takes away from printing the comics and making comics and getting good writers and things like that.
Madefire, though, hopes to encourage a new generation of creators. Its website offers free tools that allow anyone to use the motion book platform and turn their own comic book creations into dynamic artwork. Rebecca Bowring, Berkeley, California.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Monday, we expose New York's love affair with South African music. That's Monday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.